Luke chapter 2, and starting to read at verse 8. And there were shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Today, in the town of David, a Saviour has been born to you. He is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." Suddenly, a great company of the heavenly host appeared with the angel, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men on whom his favour rests." When the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about." So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things they had heard and seen, which were just as they had been told. So Christmas time is nearly upon us again. Just to start off, and for those of you with sheets, this is the first thing. In your mind's eye, or on the sheet if you've got a sheet, I'd like you to picture your perfect Christmas. What are the essential characteristics of a perfect Christmas to you? Maybe it's the setting. Maybe it's the presents. Maybe it's the time spent with family. Maybe it's hiding away in your home and wishing that it would all go away. What things would you have in order for your Christmas day to be just right? Now, I wonder, for you and for me, how much does Christ himself feature in our ideal Christmas? Do we get taken up with the picture postcard settings, the good food, the presents? It's very easy for us just to forget what's most important at this time of year. Now, Christmas can be a really good window onto what's most important to us. Generally a time where we make space, we spend money on the things that we value. And so it can actually provide us with an idea of whether things like food or gadgets or clothes or money are too important to us. Maybe relationships and providing our children with the perfect Christmas experience. Or maybe pride, because we don't go to the excesses at Christmas time that other people go to. It's easy to look down on them. Now, what I'm wanting us to think about and to get tonight, I just want to provide us with some space and some time to prepare our hearts and to prepare room for Christ in our hearts. It's very easy just to parachute into the Christmas story. It's that time of year, and all of a sudden, oh, baby Jesus in the manger. And it's easy to forget that actually this event occurs partway through a story. And that story has been carried through the whole Old Testament. And if we're just going to jump straight into the story when Jesus arrives, that'll be a bit like jumping straight to Frodo and Sam at the foot of Mount Doom when they're just about to finally save the day. Or it'll be like jumping straight to Return of the Jedi, which I used to do, and skip out The Empire Strikes Back because I didn't like that one because the baddies won in that one. It didn't make me feel good. So I'll just skip that bit of the story out and go straight to the good bit where the goodies win. But actually, you find in any good story, you need that plot tension. You need the times when things are bad, so that when the resolution comes along, it makes it all the sweeter. The darker the evil, or the more threatening it is, the better the story is when it's overcome. if it seems like all is lost and everything is hopeless, then when the hero steps in and saves the day, it makes the story so much more enjoyable. And actually, that point of resolution, when you get to the darkest point in the story, and then the hero steps onto the scene, that's the Christmas story. Everything in the Old Testament, just getting harder and harder and harder, seems to be going more and more downhill. And then Christ steps into the story in the manger. And so it's really helpful, I think, to look at the Christmas story and to think about everything that has come up to that point, because then it gives us the proper context that we can understand everything that's going on. And it can make the Christmas account so much richer and so much deeper for us. So those of you that have got sheets, we're going to have a whistle-stop tour of the Old Testament. So you're going to have to keep up, hang on to your hats. So we'll start at the very beginning with creation. And even before creation, you have the God who is three and yet one. You have Trinity. You have perfect, eternal happiness and joy and love. And that happiness and joy and love overflows outwards in creation. God creates beings who can share in that wonderful relationship that God has within himself. And God is going to showcase his glory and create beings who can appreciate and revel in that incredible glory. Just read a quick passage here from Proverbs chapter 8. She's talking about wisdom that was present when the world was formed. Wisdom personified here. And obviously we read in the New Testament that Christ is the Word who was there at the Father's hand during creation. And this just gives you a feel of the joy that was there when creation was occurring. So Proverbs 8 verse 27. I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so that the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. And that, I think, just gives you a really good window into creation, that it's the overflow of happiness and rejoicing and joy. And Adam and Eve have been created and put in this beautiful garden. They're walking with God. They're enjoying his presence. But as we know, it doesn't stay like that forever. Adam and Eve decide they want to set their own course. They don't want God telling them how to live. They don't want God telling them what's good and what's evil. So they decide to turn away from the source of life and joy in the fall. And then you can see the immediate effects of that decision. They're banished from God's presence. The beautiful garden they're kicked out of. They're filled with shame in front of each other. They're hiding from God. And now they face pain and struggle and death. And then following that, Genesis 4 to 11 just carry on the downward spiral of humanity. You get Cain and Abel with the first murder. And then you get Lamech, a man who is accumulating wives and boasts of how violent he is, how much more violent than Cain is. And then the whole earth, we're told, has become corrupted and violent and evil. And so God sends a flood. And then we think, okay, here's Noah. Maybe there's hope. Maybe all the stuff that was wrong has been wiped clean. But Noah unfortunately falls very soon afterwards and in a garden again. And then we end up at Babel, where humanity decides to unite in defiance against God. And God comes down to see the tower they've built, and he scatters them. And as Justin Mote used to say, that first 11 chapters of Genesis is the first half of the Old Testament. You've got the complete failure of humanity. And humanity is now separated from each other, separated from God, scattered. Death reigns, violence reigns, and abuse reigns. And at that point, that's when God then steps in to meet with Abraham and focuses his attention on a single family. And great promises are given to Abraham. Promises of blessing and land and all nations being blessed through him. And so you think, maybe Abraham's the one. Maybe everything's going to turn right now. Maybe humans are going to start undoing the mess they've made. But you can see throughout Abraham and his sons and his grandsons, more failings, favoritism, lying, cheating, cowardice. And it's clear that the same old failings remain, despite God's promises. And then eventually they end up in Egypt as slaves to Pharaoh. Moses calls them out. God displays his great power through the Exodus. And then they leave Egypt. God gives them the law, the conditions for how they are to live as his people. But while Moses is up there on the mountain, in the clouds and the thunder, the people are down below, creating their own God, who's a bit more domesticated, a bit more safe than this scary God who's thundering and lightning on the mountain. And they make a golden calf that they'll worship instead. It's the same rejection of God as Adam and Eve made in the garden. We don't want this God. We want to make God in our image. We want to decide what follows. And then either side of the 40 years that they spend in the wilderness, you get Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, which are key to understanding the whole Old Testament story. And basically, both of those chapters lay out the blessings if God's people obey the law and the curses that will follow should they decide to reject God and worship other idols. And Deuteronomy 28, verse 68, you get this, the final part of the curses. The Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt. So if they fail to obey, if they fail to honor God and to love God and to worship him, then they'll end up right back where they started in Egypt. But then despite the miraculous salvation from Egypt and the provision of water and food in the deserts, the Israelites grumble and they start to long for a return to Egypt already. And God rejects that entire generation to wander the wilderness. But then that generation dies out. They enter the promised land. The book of Joshua, things go pretty well, really. They win lots of victories. They take over the land that God had promised to Abraham. But they don't completely eliminate the nations that they were supposed to do. These nations who worshipped other gods and sacrificed their children and who had been living for hundreds of years in great wickedness. And then along comes Judges. And this failure to eliminate the nations comes back to haunt Israel. And there's a cycle that mirrors the whole story of the Old Testament, in that the people of Israel turn away from God to worship idols, and then they fall into the hands of the nations whose idols they are, and then they're oppressed for a period of time, and then they cry out to God. God raises up a judge, delivers them, they have peace, and then they start worshiping the idols again. And that whole cycle repeats itself. And it seems like they just can't break this cycle. It's a downward cycle. Things get progressively worse and worse in the book of Judges. And then we get the kings. So maybe if we can't get the whole nation to obey, maybe if we can just get one person to follow God and he can be in charge and tell everybody else what they should be doing, then maybe that's the solution. And David and Solomon, things are looking pretty good. Maybe we're on the up. Maybe humanity's finally going to sort itself out. But with David's failings with his family, it doesn't take long for the kingdom to split under his grandson Rehoboam. And you get Judah in the south and Benjamin, and then the tribes in the north. And again, we get this pattern of rejecting God and separation both between people and between people and God. Now, the northern kingdom, the kings are so bad and the idol worship is so prevalent that all the curses that were promised in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are brought upon them. So 732 BC, the Assyrians come and basically wipe out the northern kingdom, carry them off into exile. Despite all the warnings of the prophets to clean up their act, they just seemingly were unable to pull themselves away from their idols and follow God. Now, the southern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin, last a little bit longer. They have some generally better kings, but eventually the same thing happens. And 586 BC, they end up getting carried off into exile to Babylon. Now, a few years pass, the Persians defeat the Babylonians, and then Cyrus, the king of Persia, allows some from Judah and Benjamin to return. So the exiles return. They rebuild the temple, but some weep as it's just nothing in comparison to the old temple. And then we get 400 years of silence. And eventually along come the Romans and occupy Israel, and it all goes quiet. And that, in a nutshell, is the story of the Old Testament. The history of humanity, and then Israel in particular, is one of failure. It's one of turning away from God repeatedly and then reaping the consequences. It's turning away from the source of true joy and blessing for idols and then falling into misery and suffering and pain. The human race had something so good in the garden, and yet they threw it away. And despite God's offer of obedience to the law and all of this can be restored to you, it just keeps on coming back, this cycle. And God's take on this, very clear, in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13. He says, "Be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." I think that's quite a good summary of the Old Testament in general, really. The people reject God, the spring of living water, dig their own cisterns, turn to idols, broken cisterns that can't hold water. I'm reading a book at the moment by a guy called Randy Alcorn on happiness. There's a quote in there that I thought was really, really struck me. And here he talks about people nowadays who follow this same cycle of, we'll have nothing to do with God and we'll look anywhere else for happiness and satisfaction. So he says about those people, they eagerly drink from contaminated water surrounded by huge signs with neon letters flashing happiness. Now, the Old Testament story, we don't have any lines, we don't play any parts, but it's our story too. If you look into your life and the lives of those around you, without God, we worship anything but God. It seems like humanity is addicted to idolatry, that we just can't pull ourselves away from other things and worship God. Another quote by a lady called Kirsten Burkett. She says, "Like addiction, sin is our seeking freedom but getting slavery. It is our seeking exaltation and bliss but getting pain and dissatisfaction." She compares sin to an addiction. Like a junkie, you're addicted to this stuff, but it doesn't satisfy, so you have to keep on going back and keep on going back for more and for more. And ultimately, you end up enslaved. And that's what sin does, and that's the story of the Old Testament. Now, the Bible describes this as being in Adam, being united to Adam, so that his story is our story. We're destined to make the same mistakes. We're destined to reap the same consequences of pain and struggle and suffering and death and separation from God. And this is the ultimate plot tension. It could not get darker than this. The whole story of the Old Testament shows that despite God's incredible promises, humanity just fails, turns from him and rejects him. And that's the setting that the Christmas story comes into. And so we've got in Luke 2, Luke sets the scene for us now. And the scene is a hillside in darkness, which I think is quite a nice narrative ploy to kind of conjure up. This is where humanity is. This is where the nation of Israel is at this point. It is darkness. It's hopeless. Everything's just gone from bad to worse. The Romans are occupying, and they haven't heard anything from God for 400 years. And into that darkness, we then get the angel appearing and light shining and glory coming. And this is to shepherds. God announces his plan of salvation, not to the Caesars and to the rulers, but to the lowly and the uneducated. Shepherds weren't seen particularly favorably as a profession at this time. They were normal, common people, and yet these were chosen to be the first witnesses to God in human form. And then we get to the angel's message, and this is the heart, really, of the Christmas message. So the first thing is, you can see it there in verse 10, it's good news. Now, news is something that has happened. News is something has been done. Now, this is not Behold, I bring you three things you need to do to get close to God. I bring you four spiritual laws for success. I bring you the eight prayers that if you pray, everything will get sorted out. See, news is exactly what is needed at this point, because the whole Old Testament story, and when we look at our own lives as well, it proves that in ourselves, we just don't have it in us to sort ourselves out. I can tell you exactly who we don't need in the story at this point, and that is Father Christmas. Because what Father Christmas would do at this point is he'd come along and he'd say, just be good for goodness sake. Father Christmas comes with a message that is completely contrary to what humans need to hear. We've had hundreds and hundreds of years of the failure of people to meet God's standards, to sort themselves out. And so the last thing that we need to hear at this point is just clean up your act a little bit, and if you're good enough, then you'll get some blessings, and if you're bad, then you won't get them. There's a good quote here from a theologian called Michael Horton, just on the idea of gospel. He says, "It's interesting that the biblical writers chose the word gospel. The heart of most religions is good advice, good techniques, good programs, good ideas, and good support systems. But the heart of Christianity is good news. It comes not as a task for us to fulfill or a mission for us to accomplish, but as a report that someone has already fulfilled, accomplished, followed, and achieved everything else for us. It's good news because it does not depend on us. It's about God and his faithfulness to his own promises." See, this is about news. This reminds me of in the Narnia series, when in the first one, all the animals are scurrying around and there's this buzz going around. Have you heard that Aslan is on the move? And it's news. It's that somebody is doing something. God is doing something. And this is so good because the Christmas story is about being lifted out of Adam and that story and being united to Christ. Christ becomes man so that we can be joined with him. His story becomes our story. We die with him, we are raised with him, and our destiny becomes intertwined with his rather than with Adam's. And the second thing about this angel's message, it's great joy. This is what the news brings, good news of great joy. Now what sin seeks to do is it seeks to divorce happiness from God. It seeks to say, you don't need God and what he says to be happy. You can decide what makes you happy. So we can take happiness away from God and we can put it on money, or we can put it on relationships, or we can put it on video games, or we can put it on anything else in the whole of creation, just as long as it's not to do with God. But that leaves us ultimately with neither happiness nor God, because true lasting happiness can't be found outside of God. That's the situation we find ourselves in. We've decided to look for happiness away from God, and as a result, we've lost God and we've lost the only true source of happiness. But this news is about how that sin can be dealt with and how we can have a renewed relationship with God. Another quote here from John Piper, which I really like. He says, "The highest, best, final, decisive good of the gospel, without which no other gifts would be good, is the glory of God in the face of Christ revealed for our everlasting enjoyment. The saving love of God is God's commitment to do everything necessary to enthrall us with what is most deeply and durably satisfying, namely himself. Since we are sinners and have no right and no desire to be enthralled with God, therefore God's love enacted a plan of redemption to provide that right and that desire." So this is good news that sin is going to be dealt with so that we can be restored in relationship to God. Then we can enjoy what is truly most deeply satisfying, and that is God himself. Now, salvation doesn't just result in happiness for us. Passage in Zephaniah chapter 3, it starts with our happiness, and then it takes the same root words and then applies those words to God himself. So in Zephaniah 3 verse 14, we read, "Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout aloud, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away your punishment. He has turned back your enemy. The Lord, the King of Israel, is with you. Never again will you fear any harm." So you get the feel there of the joy and the excitement that God's people are to have because he's taken away their punishment. He's turned away their enemy. He's with you. But then in verse 17, we then read, "The Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take great delight in you. He will quiet you with his love. He will rejoice over you with singing." And so the Christmas time is not just a time for us to rejoice. God himself rejoices that our relationship can be restored. And this reminded me of the prodigal's father, the joy that he had running down the road to his son and then throwing the huge party. Christmas time is a time of joy because it's a time of reconciliation. God has seen us ruining our lives by rejecting him and chasing after happiness wherever else we can find it. And yet in the gospel, he comes down as a man to save us from that addiction to sin and that slavery to sin and to renew our relationship with him. 1 Timothy chapter 1 verse 11 talks about the gospel as good news of the glory of the happy God. So in the gospel, not just happiness for us, the gospel brings happiness to God himself. John 15 verse 11, "I have told you all these things so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete." So it's great news, it's good news. Something has been done, it's not down to you. It's great joy, it's restoration to relationship with God so that we can enjoy what is most deeply and durably satisfying. And it's also for all the people. It's for these lowly shepherds. They're the first people who hear. The sign, you'll find him lying in a manger. The point here is that this is a sign for the shepherds. If the angel had said, "You will find him lying in a palace," the shepherds would probably have thought, "Oh, that's a shame. No one's going to let us in a palace." But the fact is, he's lying in a manger. He's lying somewhere that is accessible to you. This is not good news for the people with enough money to buy it. This is good news for the lowly and the common and the outcasts. And I think the main point here about all people is that you and I are included in this. It's good news for all, including me and including you. There's no ethnic groups or religious groups or sexualities that are excluded if they come in repentance and faith. There's no distinction between the rich and the poor or the old and the young or the intelligent and the simple. This is good news of great joy for all people. And it's a saviour. It's Christ the Lord, the Messiah, God's anointed king. All through the failure of the Old Testament, there were glimpses of hope, promises that were given. Even as far back as Genesis 3, straight after the fall, one is promised who'll crush the head of the serpent. And then the promises to Abraham of blessing to all nations. A promise to David of a king who will reign forever and ever, and who all nations will obey. And then through Isaiah, that one will come and bear our sins away, will crush the serpent's head. One will usher in a new creation, return everything the way it was before the fall. And so the Old Testament story finally finds its resolution. Light comes in the midst of great darkness and freedom from guilt and from slavery. Then we can see here in Luke 2, just as we close, some of the responses. And these should be our responses as well to the Christmas story. So the angels and the shepherds glorify God and they sing praise to God. They just overflow in joy at the fact that God is stepping down to finally turn the story round and bring joy and bring peace and bring reconciliation to him. Notice as well, the shepherds spread the word about the child. They go out, they tell others, they share this news. Mary's response, I think, is a really helpful one for us at this time of year. She treasures up all these things in her heart and she ponders them or she meditates on them. She thinks through them. She doesn't get caught up in the busyness of everything that's happening. She takes the time to think about, to treasure, to value, and to go over in her mind and in her heart all of the blessings and all the wonder and all the glory that there is in this Christmas story. Now, just to conclude, I've adapted slightly adapted a John Piper quote, just for us to think about and reflect on this Christmas time. If you could have Christmas with no sickness and with all your family and your friends and all the food that you ever liked and all the leisure activities you ever enjoyed and all the presents that your heart ever desired and your children's eyes wide with the magic of it all and the picture-perfect snowfall, no conflict and no arguments, could you be satisfied with that Christmas if Christ was not in it? And so, for us this Christmas time, let's not settle for lesser things. Let's rejoice in this good news of great joy that is for all the people. Let's rejoice in this story, the greatest story that there is. The story of the one who stepped down into the darkest, blackest, most hopeless situation and has brought unimaginable joy as a result.